Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Offshore Wind Podcast. My name's Stuart Mullen. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at the Global Wind Energy Council, and I'm here at the desk, as always, with Mr. David Lenti, the Head of Offshore Corporate Affairs at Siemens Gamesa Renewable Energy. David, welcome.
Very good day to you, Stuart. Thanks for having me here again, and I'm super, super excited to have our guest on today.
Yeah, me too, and this is our second episode on the topic of hydrogen and also looking at people that are getting stuff done. And talking about people that are getting stuff done, I don't think there's anyone in the entire global wind industry that has got as much done as our next guest. It's a great honour to have you once again join the Offshore Wind Podcast, Mr. Henrik Stiesdal, the CEO of Stiesdal Industries.
Yeah, thank you, Stuart, and thanks for having me.
No worries. Our pleasure. So, Henrik, just for those that might be new to offshore wind, we're getting a lot of new markets on a regular basis. Can you give our listeners a little bit of background about yourself and how long you've been in the industry? And I mean, yeah, we could do like a 6-hour podcast just on this topic alone, but a very potted history of your history in wind and also perhaps a little bit about how you first thought about offshore wind.
Yes, I started all the way back in 1976 as a pioneer with the intent of building a wind turbine for my parents' farm in order to reduce the energy cost of running the farm. And as part of that effort, I got involved in looking at whether one could actually build a commercial turbine. And in the end, together with a local blacksmith, I developed a commercial turbine. And after a few successful installations, we needed to get moving. And the only realistic way was to find a licensee for our technology. And that licensee became Vestas. And that's how they got started in wind.
Oh, wow.
I then had a very good collaboration with Vestas until 86 while I was studying. And after that, I joined Bonus, another Danish wind company, in 1987. That company was, I became the technical manager in 88 and was with the company until 2014. But on that timeline, we sold the company to Siemens in 2004. So I had something like 17 years with Bonus and 10 years with the same company, but under a much larger group constellation. And it has, of course, been super exciting to follow that. Already when I was young and early in the field of wind, I noticed that when there were big international conferences, offshore wind was mentioned as the solution of the future. So if you look in old conference proceedings from around 1980, they will have all kinds of articles about offshore wind, but nobody did anything until the Danish government decided in 1989 to instruct the two big utility groups we had at that time in Denmark to each build a 5-megawatt offshore demonstration plant. And I had the good luck to be involved in the creation of the first of those that was installed in 1991. I was responsible for the technical solution on the turbines. So I have had the opportunity to follow the industry right from the first thing anything went into the sea. For our company, the next big step was Middelgrunden outside Copenhagen with its 22 megawatt turbines. And later on, of course, the much bigger projects that we are still seeing growing every day. In 2009, I also had the good luck to be involved in the deployment of the first floating offshore wind turbine together with Equinor. They had developed the High Wind Demo, and we and Siemens supplied the turbine for that project at 2.3 megawatt turbine. So it has been a very exciting journey also with regards to all the concerns along the way about whether we could get cheap enough soon enough, which of course fortunately has ended with the simple answer that maybe not soon enough, to be quite frank, but we certainly have got to be cheap enough with offshore wind.
Thank you for that, Henrik. Perhaps the most understated explanation of your of one person's influence in and involvement in the wind industry I've ever heard. But that we're very, very happy to have you here. And you, so 2014, when actually all three of us, myself, Stuart, and you, were employed by the former Siemens Wind Power, you left the company and then eventually formed the company you have now, Steesdale Technologies, and then the umbrella companies that are a founder of that. Can you give us a little bit of background as to what you are doing now?
Yes, I left Siemens after having been for about 27 years with the company, happy with having been there, but also in a way needing to be able to spend more time with my old parents and so on at the time. Mm-hmm. They have since died, and I have moved on and created a company that does climate solutions. We have four affiliates, each targeting a technical field that we think could benefit from what we might be able to bring into it. The logic there being that we are looking for areas where our experience in industrialization and mass production might help different technologies. So we have an affiliate that does floating offshore wind. We have one that does energy storage. We have one that does hydrogen. And we have a fourth one that does carbon negative fuels through pyrolysis. In all four, the learning from the wind industry is, you can say, the sort of linchpin of it all. Mm-hmm. I have been involved in offshore, as I said, from the very, very early days. And of course, it has been technically very, very exciting and gratifying and fun. And the turbines have grown from the 450 kilowatt, half megawatt turbines of 91 to the 15 megawatt turbines of today, which in itself has been super exciting. But it has also been exciting at what you would call a meta level, in looking at how does an industry get to be, what happens when what is that drives the main parameters of such an industry. And when you are in energy production, there are some things that you are want to happen. One, of course, is that your products need to be very robust so that they can deliver energy whenever it's possible. But the other one being, of course, that it needs to be affordable. And I have fought for many, many years to change the fundamental questions that was very often, if not stated outright, then at least an underlying presumption in offshore wind, which was, we really would like to go green, but we are not sure we can afford it. So I worked on changing that question from how can we afford it to how can we afford not to. And we have succeeded, and I say we, it's not me, it's the industry that has succeeded in crossing the line of competitiveness with conventional fuels. So now offshore wind is, at least in this part of the world around the North Sea, cheaper than power generation by fossil fuels. And there on this sort of meta level, which is interesting to follow, you cannot help asking why. What is it that drove this huge improvement in cost? And I have myself been much involved in making innovations and also inventions and doing things that could be patented and all that jazz. And it's been great fun. The real thing that has made it affordable is not that. The real thing that has made it affordable is that we reached a level of volume where we could go into genuine mass production. Not only mass production of the turbines, but also mass production of foundations and cables and so on, and even industrialization of the logistic food chain of the projects. And that is and remains the most important lever for cost reduction, that's industrialization. So what I'm doing, for instance, on floating wind is that I'm working on industrialization of floating wind, because industrialization is the lever to cost reduction. And so what I'm working with on floating offshore wind is to basically, you can say, I have looked around at somebody who was, and seeing if I could find somebody who had been successful in making very big structures economically attractive. How did they go about that? And I didn't need to look much further than to the neighbors on the turbine side. So when I wanted to make floaters really low cost, I looked at how do wind turbines get to be really low cost. And there the answer is that they are modularized so that each module is no bigger than it can be manufactured in a factory. That is the whole trick. So there's nobody making a three-bladed rotor in one piece. It would make no sense, because then you could not benefit from factory manufacturing. Nobody is making a tower in one piece. A customer could be excused for asking, why are you selling me a tower in three pieces, giving me for the next 25 years two bolted flange connections I need to maintain? Can I please have a tower in one piece? And we would have to tell that potential customer, no, you cannot. We know that logically it could make sense, but then you would miss the cost reduction that is possible by making it in modules that can be factory built. And you would not want to see what would be a price penalty of missing that opportunity. And that is why all the offshore turbines in the world are made with towers in sections, even though you could argue that why do you want anything that requires maintenance, where you could build it in one section and not have the sections. That is because even when taking into account the maintenance requirements, the sectionalized tower is much, much more attractive. And we are simply taking that logic to the floating foundations. So I'm trying in the company I founded and am helping running now. It's no longer a single person company. We are a little over 100 staff. Mm. I'm trying we are trying to take benefit of the learnings we had through all the years.
Yep. So there's a couple of, well, thank you first for that explanation about how you've managed to bring in those standardization into, and what actually affects standards and industrialization and modularization actually can have on in production. One of the things that you mentioned about the competitiveness of the turbines, or like the price competitiveness now, I actually think that there was a degree of competition that actually led to this as well, you know, like that when developers actually had, you know, more than one OEM that was in the market for, you know, then all of a sudden there was a price competition between the OEMs, and that sort of expedited some, you know, fierce competition. And I think that if you extrapolate that also into the floating foundation market, that we're also seeing, I don't know, maybe there's lots of different types of floating foundations at the moment that we could choose from. And maybe there's a lack of scale at the moment in terms of projects that actually help us determine the winner here. Maybe there's not going to be one winner or two winners or three winners. Maybe that we'll continue to roll this out, but it'd be pretty interesting to hear what your take about that is. And also, if I remember correctly, didn't you originally, in your floating foundation, didn't you sort of come up with your first take on this was some sort of almost like a, what was it called? Like a open source foundation where you kind of laid the pattern, you gave the pattern or instructions for free and said, there you go, world, you know, you can industrialize this at will. Did that concept not take on? Is there not enough people willing to buy that? And how did that work out?
Yeah, if we take the last part first, yes, I did actually start when I had left Siemens with an open source idea. At that time, I didn't want to start a new company. I had basically been responsible for many people for many years in the old companies. For more than 25 years, I had been managing a lot of people, and I was kind of, I had had my fill with that. And at the same time, I wanted to do something for the world. And then the idea came up, could I do something in open source? Yeah. And a good old friend from DNV, GL, as it was at the time, Henrik Madsen, who was at that time the CEO of DNV, he actually thought that that was an interesting idea, not yet known in offshore wind. And therefore, he very generously helped me get for about €500,000 of support from DNVGL in developing the concept of this modular floater. So at the end of 15, I was ready to go out with a concept that was fairly well thought out and had had all the benefits of having all the huge expertise of DNV supporting the project. And a lot of universities heard about it and they were keen, and I've done a large number of master projects and also some PhD projects on the concept with students. And a lot of suppliers were interested, and the big developers didn't want it. Out of logic that said, well, if we help you, we help our competitors. We don't want to do that. Open source, no. And then in early 16, I had to realize that no matter the technical qualities, if as I felt there were of the concept, it was not going to happen because the developers didn't want anything that was just shared knowledge. And therefore I had to bite the bullet and create a company out of logic that said, okay, if they don't want it for free, they can pay. And that's how we got started on that. Regarding the competition, that's of course clear that the best way to get cheap products is to have competition. And one thing that did happen during the 2010s was that in all the major markets, the feed-in system changed from a fixed tariff to an auction system. So there was a very high pressure on developers, and then further down the food chain, the turbine OEMs and the foundation suppliers and so on, to reduce costs in order to be able to win auctions. But you can also say that you can have as much motivation as you want and squeeze as much as you want. It still won't help if you don't have a solution to how can you actually get the cost down.
Sure.
And that solution was industrialization.
But so then, sorry,
industrialization was the so to speak vehicle by which you were able to meet that competitive pressure. Yeah. On the floaters, it's clear that we have now, I think we have more than 50 different concepts. And of course, in the long run, that will not be viable because, first of all, some of them are perhaps less likely than others to be robust in the long run. But the second thing is that applying exactly the logic of industrialization, if you have 50 different concepts, they can't all get scale and then they can't all get industrialized. So there will be a range of winners, however many that may be, 3, 5, 7 different concepts, but they need to be able to, shall we say, get mass production into the game. Otherwise, those that can get mass production will leave them behind.
Right. And speaking of industrializing and moving ahead, when we're talking about hydrogen production, again, to simplify it, it's a relatively easy thing to do explain. What are your views on hydrogen? What are you working with within your company? And what do you see of challenges and opportunities?
Yes, that's actually a good question. If you had asked me 10 years ago, I would have said that hydrogen has a tendency to be hyped at regular intervals and then fizzle out again. And now we have a big hydrogen hype. And now I actually changed my view and say it's here for good. It'll be a king size industry in the coming decades. The reason being that hydrogen is the only feasible way to get from electricity to forms of energy that are not, at least not in for part of the path, electricity. The only way from electricity to another energy form is through hydrogen. And if we are going to meet our climate targets, we are going to deliver huge amounts of energy that cannot be taken in as electricity. That goes both for stored energies, it goes for energies that can be supplied in areas with poor electrical grids and with no means of actually building up the necessary grids for direct electricity supply. It goes for steel production and ammonia production that are now done in very climate harmful ways with fossil fuels. And it goes for a wide range of industries that, no matter what we do, cannot be fully electrified, like shipping and so on. All of those will need fuel, renewable energy in another form than electricity. And the only way into that is through hydrogen. So I'm very confident that that will grow to be a huge business. The way we go about that in the company is that, the history behind why we are at all looking at hydrogen is that originally we didn't think that we had the bandwidth to also do that, but we needed some green hydrogen to be able to make methanol out of our synthesis gas we get out of the pyrolysis plant. And therefore, we shopped around for green hydrogen and discovered to our horror how expensive it was at the time, which was 2019. And then we asked the good old childish question, why? And the answer we got from the surrounding industry was two reasons. Renewable energy is expensive and electrolyzers are expensive. And I said, that's not true because renewable energy is cheap. I said, well, actually, yes, you're right there, but electrolyzers are expensive. And then we asked the child question again, why? And it turned out that, at least in our assessment, it was because it was not yet industrialized. And then we are back into the same sing-song that I already spent some hot air on. It's our experience that industrialization is what takes down the cost. Let's get hydrogen industrialized. And that is what we are working on in the company.
And so when you say working on the company, Henrik, one of the things that we're trying to do in this podcast is actually shine a light on things that are actually happening on the ground here and now. Because as you said, there is a bit of a hype, or there has been a bit of a hype around hydrogen. And I don't think you can have you definitely can't have a wind conference these days without hydrogen being a big component of, and it makes sense. There's a great complementary aspect to all of this, as you pointed out. But in terms of where you are in the development the cycle of your technology and the patents of your technology, where are you today specifically?
Yes, we started the project in 2020 and spent that year and in 21 in developing our understanding of the technology. You cannot say that we developed the technology, because hydrogen technology, and particularly the alkaline technology that we're using, has been known for 100 years. But developing ways that we thought would be useful for the industrialization. And just these days, we are assembling our first 3-megawatt unit, which will be the first commercial size that we will be building. So that's where we are. We expect to supply some of those electrolyzers next year and then go into mass production in 24.
And how have you built the scalability into that prototype? Well, maybe that's patented information. But yeah. If you can share that information with the world.
Yeah. What it's really all about, and it's not rocket science. What it's all about is to think in the way that you need to think when you design for scale manufacturing. So what you do is that you think, how can we manufacture this in a lean manner? If we want to manufacture it ourselves, is one thing. Could there be suppliers who already are doing something like this that could easily be transferred to supply to us? The second thing is there an industry out there that is really squeezed on cost? And do they have production of components that could serve electrolyzers? If there is, then we should lean on them. And this second thing is actually the most important, much more important than this or that design detail. That is to look for people who are already in mass production in a low-cost market. Could they support us? And as it turns out, and this won't be a surprise to you guys, the wind industry is a very good place to go. The wind industry is heavily pressurized on cost, and it also has a lot of high-end manufacturers, because it's also very demanding on quality and robustness. So our, just to give an example, our power supply is manufactured by one of the controller suppliers who are really good at making low-cost controllers for wind turbines. Our pressure tank is made by people who make wind turbine towers because they are very low-cost and competitive. The pumps and coolers are made by people who are suppliers to the wind industry because they know about the cost of competitiveness. And that is the most important, you can say, means by which we get to be low cost and competitive. That is by having this thinking that we should not reinvent the wheel, shouldn't even start about not having invented it, but building our own first wheel. Yep. We should look at those who build wheels by the hundreds of thousands or millions, because they are the ones who have already passed a good part of the learning curve and have already reduced the cost significantly. And then when it comes to this repeated question about, is this just another hype? Will things change? There's one thing that changes if you can do a low cost product, and it's not, it for me at least, it may be self-evident for others. For me, it was not self-evident. I only, so to speak, discovered it. It's through this process by which we are doing hydrogen in our company. And that is that if you can do cheap electrolyzers, you don't need to do complex projects when you implement it. And with that, I mean that very often you will see that people will say, oh yes, but hydrogen is much better with combinations of solar and wind, because then you get a high capacity factor. Yep. Preferably you should also add it so that you can take power from the grid when there's no wind, because then you can have a really high capacity factor on your hydrogen electrolyzer, even though the cost of electricity will often be much higher when there's no wind, because we are helping bring down the cost. If you have a cheap product, that logic doesn't apply. Because if you have a cheap investment good, so to speak, then you don't care if it is not producing all the time, because it doesn't cost you much to have it standing idle because it was cheap to buy. And therefore, a low-cost electrolyzer fits eminently well with a 40 or 50% wind installation when it comes to capacity factor. It doesn't need to run all the time because it was cheap, so it can just stand still when there's no wind. And that makes for a very simple installation. And that's one of the levers for getting hydrogen really off the ramp. That is CapEx. When you have cheap electricity, CapEx is king. When you have expensive electricity, efficiency is king. But we'll have an abundance of cheap electricity. And that means that you need to do low-cost electrolyzers. Yeah. Then you can live with this very simple combination of a wind farm and electrolyzers to give cheap energy to society. And this actually opens, if I should take a little loop back to our pet subject, which is offshore wind, this opens for a new way of thinking that could benefit not only bottom fixed, but also floating. Floating in the sort of higher level of aggregation is a way whereby you expand the potential of offshore wind. IEA some years back calculated that if we do floating wind, we multiply our resource by a factor of 10, because we can go places that we couldn't go with bottom fixed. Yep. That's good. So far, so good. Yep. Having hydrogen attached to floating opens yet another flexibility, because it allows us to install offshore wind farms in places where there's no grid. Because you can just ship then a much easier shippable product, either hydrogen directly, or you could even convert it into an even more shippable form, which is ammonia. And in that way, we vastly expand the potential to feed the world with energy. Because with floating wind, we can go places you can't go, large parts of the world with bottom fixed offshore. And with hydrogen production, we can even go to places where there's no grid and won't be a grid for a long time. And I really think that these are key levers to opening the door for huge expansions of renewable energy supplies.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. And in terms of the other two areas of your organization, Henrik, the storage and the carbon negative fuels, are you then also driving demand for the supply you're creating as well in this area? Are you locking in both demand and supply? Because this is the thing that when I look at the hydrogen puzzle, it seems like we're trying to grow both the supply and demand for hydrogen at the same time. Is that an accurate assumption, or am I missing something?
If I take the last part of the question first, I understand your logic in asking that question, of course. You could say the same about the fact that we now have renewables, because there, when we started building wind turbines, we were both building the means by producing electricity and trying to make it acceptable for a market. Yep. And there we drove, to some extent, both a supply and a demand. The demand was in the early years driven in collaboration with politicians because it needed subsidy arrangements. But if we had not been very active towards the politicians, we would not have had the subsidy regimes, and then we would not have had a wind industry.
Yep.
So we have actually done the same. I think that for hydrogen, it will be easier, because if we can make green ammonia that is competitive with people say gray, if they're in the industry, I think of it as black.
Yep.
Ammonia. Yeah. If you can do that, you don't have to create a demand. There's already a demand for low carbon ammonia. Ammonia doesn't in itself have carbon, but the way you produce it now out of natural gas is a major CO2 emitter. You have it also in steel production, where steel is made with a coal as a what we call a reduction agent in order to get the iron out of the iron ore. You can use hydrogen for that instead of coal and take away. I think, I don't recall the exact figure, I think it's about 4% of global emissions. If you take ammonia, just to put this into perspective, if we were to supply green ammonia to replace the 180 million tons of black ammonia that is being used in the world today, mainly for fertilizers, it requires 1,000 gigawatts of offshore wind.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that means that there's nobody out there who wouldn't want to buy green ammonia if they could get it at the same cost as black ammonia. That means that I don't need to create a market. If the market is there, I just need to create green ammonia that's cheap enough when it's fed by offshore wind. Then I have a market craving for my product. So I don't think that we are trying to drive. You can say the market will come by itself when we make cheap enough hydrogen. That's fundamentally the logic.
Yeah. Worry from the Global Wind Energy Council's perspective is that, and I think you kind of answered this before when you said it's coming quicker, but sometimes I feel that the hydrogen discussion, it pushes the electrification argument a little bit further. It puts us a little bit behind, and it becomes a bit of a distraction for direct electrification, because we can say, okay, we're going to install so much capacity of hydrogen production later down the track that it's going to solve all of our challenges. But and then maybe it sort of breaks the here and now of the technology that we need to be installing more of, and the projects that we need to be installing here and now with technology, not necessarily waiting for something better or another form of energy to come along. Do you see that at all? Is that the wrong way to view the problem?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think it's right, to be quite frank.
Good.
Because I don't think that the things are being delayed for this reason. Things are being delayed in the green transition enormously and hugely annoyingly by bad habits on planning. The world desperately needs a set of best practices for planning and execution from the regulatory side of renewable installations. That is the key. Once we get acceleration on planning, in a way, you can say that it does not matter whether we go for direct electrification or substitution of fuels with hydrogen-based alternatives, in the end, the money will speak.
Yep.
For those solutions will win that give the best economy. But for the climate, it's okay that our things are not directly electrified, but are fit with hydrogen. It gives the same end result. We need a little more, somewhat more energy production to do it through the hydrogen pathway than where we can electrify it. But we will also save some capex here and there by not having to convert things that run well on fuels to try and run on electricals.
Sure.
So in the end, it's a matter of money. So I think that here we are, in a way, being concerned about the wrong thing. What we should be concerned about and do all that is in our might to make happen is to get the processes by which projects can be executed, accelerated, so that it doesn't take 8 or 10 years to get permission for an offshore wind farm, but takes 1 or 2 or 3, and one is not realistic, 2 or 3 years instead. Then the market will come by itself.
I'm really happy you said that, Henrik, because that's one of the key messages that we as a company from Siemens Gamesa side and are pushing across the industry and across the, you know, regulatory affairs and governmental affairs work that we do, because we can see that we need this acceleration of the permitting. We need to have things reduced that will allow us to, again, make the electrolyzers better, make them less expensive, and then at the same time ensure the deployment and the growth. If I look at some of the things, and I know we're talking about having a better energy management system and better control units, that so they're fundamentally in place, looking at the commercial and operational successes for green hydrogen, it's just something that's still not taking place fast enough, and we just need to really pick that up.
Yes.
But I mean, again, if I understand correctly some of the assumptions, and maybe, Henrik, this is a little bit about my question before, when I was at MHI Vestas, we were looking at this the hydrogen production at a turbine, and it was exceptionally clear that once you get past, I think it's like 90 kilometers from shore or something, that the gas infrastructure becomes exponentially cheaper than like DC cabling to the same thing. So I guess the fear was that once you start, once you start getting further from shore, that most of the developers are going to just want to do hydrogen production. They're going to forget about like direct electrification. And I don't know whether that's what the world needs from offshore wind, but maybe it is. I mean, and as you said, there's definitely a need.
Yes. I of course understand the question and I understand the concern, but in a way, I don't think that for us who are you and I, you speak from an organization that, like me, is mainly focused on generation of energy that can substitute fossil.
Exactly.
Fossil is the key culprit in the climate challenge, the climate disaster. 73%, I think it is, of human-made emissions or human-influenced emissions are from fossil fuel combustion. That's our main target. We need to substitute that. We can substitute that with electricity in some fields. In other fields, it needs something else than electricity. And then there's a gray area in between. I think that the market will drive where the ultimate boundaries are in this gray area. We cannot solve the problem of things that cannot be electrified by installing more offshore wind farms. You will not electrify the production of iron out of iron ore. You will not electrify ammonia production or fertilizer production without having raw materials like hydrogen. So they will need conversion. Then there are big parts of society and they're growing that will just need electricity. And then we have something in between where it might be fuel-based or it might be electricity-based. Let the market figure that out. That's not our concern. Our concern is to overwhelm the world with cheap electricity that can then be converted into fuel forms. And all those fuel forms, they go through hydrogen. That's kind of how I see it.
Yeah, and I guess, Henrik, well, thank you very much for that. And I'm glad that it's a great explanation, and it's one of these challenges that GWIC actually deals with on a daily basis. And you're exactly right. You know, the enemy here is the fossil fuel, and everything else is just something in between, just a discussion in between. So
yes.
Thank you very much for that. We are at the top of the hour. I mean, I could talk to you for literally days on end about these sort of things. And again, I know that you also have grand ambitions about what's needed to be done from a policy side and what needs to be done from an industry side. So maybe there's even another podcast we could probably do a series on from Steesdale Technologies at some stage as well.
I would concur with that, Stuart. Absolutely agree.
Yeah, but
that sounds good. Let's have that as a target. You just count me in.
Fantastic. Every Friday we can shoot the breeze about something. Anyway, good. But every time we have a guest on the program, we like to ask them about what's caught their attention over the last week. So what's caught your attention in the wind industry over the last, well, maybe not week, maybe the recent history?
Yeah, early December we had the... There was actually one thing that I thought when you invited for this podcast that I thought was really relevant. And that was that early December, we had the results from the California auction for floating offshore wind. There were five sites tendered out, three in sort of mid-California in an area called Morro Bay, and two in Northern California in an area called Humboldt. Five different companies or consortia won each one a site. And what I found really interesting was that the two highest bids were the two up in Humboldt, because Humboldt is characterized by not having any export capability of electricity at all. It can take about, not at all, it can take about 100, maybe 150 megawatts in total out of the area. But the total capacity of these two sites will be on the order of 2 gigawatts. So it has less than 10% export capacity. And yet big players like RWE and CIP are willing to pay substantial dollar amounts to secure those sites. And there you can't help thinking, are they crazy or what? Why are they paying for sites where there's no export capability? And I can assure you that these companies are not crazy. So the logic must be that they already for these projects think in hydrogen production and ways of converting electricity into other forms that can be shipped. And that is kind of a representation of what I mentioned earlier, that with floating offshore wind and, shall we say, a certain freedom of thinking in relation to grid capacity, we can vastly expand our resource. These companies are doing exactly what I'm thinking about here, which is that you can bring in floating offshore wind to an area that doesn't have grid export and still make a very attractive business out of it. Yeah, of course, they haven't done it yet, but they are certainly counting on it if you look at the dollar amounts that they have been bidding. I think that these are examples of the future.
I think that's a really astute observation, particularly as you said, you know, RWE with their Aquaventus footprint here in Germany, and all they're kind of all chips in on the hydrogen, offshore wind to hydrogen, and CIP. I think they also did a presentation at COP27 recently in Egypt about how they're thinking that a big chunk of their energy island production is going to be related to or based for hydrogen production as well. So I think that's really interesting. I hadn't actually picked up the export capacity or the grid capacity up there. So that's a really great get. And also that, you know, they are, I guess, the two smaller of the leasing rounds, but there's still, some top dollar that they're paying for that. And also the fact that all of these areas are floating offshore wind as well. I mean, you know, we're talking about driving scale in this area as well.
Yeah, it's really, when you work with floating offshore wind, the California development is really fantastic and a great beacon of how we need to go in the future.
Yeah. David, what about yourself? Has anything caught your term attention recently?
Yeah, one of the things that really did catch my eye was a post that we see at Siemens Gamesa pushed out by the global CEO Jochen Eickholt, and it was looking at things from a larger perspective, looking especially at the need for a coherent approach to raw materials and all the growth of looking at offshore wind and wind in general. So wind power capacity, not just offshore, but overall, has 190 gigawatts installed just in Europe, which is, you know, may seem like quite a bit, and it is. By 2030, the EU has a target of having 510 gigawatts installed, and that is absolutely phenomenal. But how do we get there? How do we manage this? How do we make, again, the targets into concrete orders, into a solid pipeline, and so on? And where is the amount of raw materials that we simply need for that? Just looking at steel, we're going to need about 120 million tons of steel by 2050. And that's not just Siemens Gamesa, but again, the entire industry. That is only, and I say this in air quotes, about 6% of all the steel that's produced in 1 year. So targets are very high, demands are very high, yet it should be manageable for all of us to find a good way to procure, produce, install, and use these raw materials. So one of the things we're pushing for, again, and I encourage all of you to read this, so you can find it on LinkedIn, is, you know, make sure our governments define the auction volumes that we need, that these auctions also account for price increases, you know, indexing for inflation and qualities such as CO2 emissions and diverse supply chains, and also that we as an industry have the ability to stockpile some raw materials in a very strategic and affordable ways. We don't want any disruptions, again, coming from something like a pandemic or a war somewhere that no one had expected. So that was really a attention getter for me.
Yeah, thanks for that, David. Well, for myself, I think I was listening to Mads Nipper from the CEO of Ørsted recently on the radio, and he was talking about that they'd entered into a partnership with an environmental fund. And they were talking about that in offshore wind development, there should be other contingencies rather than price. And I know, Henrik, when you were at Siemens Wind Power back in the day, it was you. I think you introduced the term, instead of looking at just purely at the levelized cost of energy, you looked at the social cost of energy as well.
Yes.
And I think that this is really interesting. And you know, Ørsted have been one of the biggest offshore wind developers in the world, and they're talking about making sure that as a guardian, as a a steward of the ocean, they have an obligation not just to create power, but to do it in a way that fossil fuels have been ignoring for generations. You know, we can't be a renewable energy and causing environmental damage. So he was talking about getting extra. You know, it doesn't always have to be about price the entire time. We can talk about, and Henrik, you mentioned the term yourself, affordable. Affordable doesn't necessarily mean the cheapest. I mean, you know, if you have enough money, a Mercedes can be an affordable car. I mean, it depends on your perspective of what affordable is. And I think that by raising and bringing different things into the assessment criteria, and he gave it the example of the Netherlands and how they've run their auctions and how they build in sort of like environmental stuff. And he was talking about not only just the natural reefs that occur when you install an offshore wind park, but maybe taking the time to build something adjacent to the wind park. You know, you can't trawl where there's cabling, so all along the cabling lines maybe there's some natural reefs that can be built along that. Anyway, I just thought it was really fascinating, and it was food for thought. I think that that's probably the way that we all need to start looking at this.
I think also along those lines, Stuart, and looking at you, Henrik, here, I believe I remember supporting you during a GWEC event with Steve Sawyer, the legend that he was, about the societal cost of energy, if I recall correctly. And I remember doing that very, very clearly, how it was, an absolute eye-opener for me.
Yes. It's a good way to look at it. And it's, of course, very encouraging that Ørsted is taking up that beacon now.
Outstanding. Look, we are at the top of the hour, so thank you very much, Mr. Henrik Stiesdahl, for joining us today. It's been absolute fantastic to speak to you.
As always, listeners, you can find the Offshore Wind Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
And even where you find some of the crapper podcasts, I think we're there too. Anyway, anyway, if you like what you hear, please write, leave a review, subscribe, say how wonderful we are. And if you don't, David's always there to take complaints. So thank you very much for joining us. And we look forward to catching you next time. Enjoy. Thank you, listeners. And thank you once again, Henrik Stiesdale.
Sure.